You're listening to a Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders 30th Anniversary Podcast. Founded in 1978, GLAAD is New England's leading legal rights organization dedicated to ending discrimination based on sexual orientation, HIV status, and gender identity and expression. For more information and updates on GLAAD's current legal work, visit us at glaad.org.
David O'Connor grew up in suburban Dublin in the 1970s, at a time of near constant violence in Northern Ireland, and back when the Irish economy was far from the Celtic tiger it is today. O'Connor's family observed Irish Catholic rituals and traditions, Catholic school, Sunday Mass, daily Mass during Lent. St. Patrick's Day was a religious holiday to spend with family and to celebrate Ireland. For David and his siblings, sisters Mary and Deirdre, and brother Paddy, the day was also a reprieve. It was the one day during Lent they got to eat candy.
It was a very important day. You know, our sense of just patriotism in that regard was very strong, and it was a day that definitely was celebrated. Also, during Lent, we all had to give up sweets or candy, and St. Patrick's Day was the one day we actually got to go back on them. So I remember a lot of tummy aches at night because we'd stuff ourselves silly because we knew that we probably had two more weeks of Lent going after that. So That was our letting our hair down, was eating too much candy on St. Patrick's Day as well.
O'Connor moved to Boston from Ireland in 1989 after college. Looking for job opportunities, he couldn't find at home. He felt at ease in a city with a large Irish population. The annual St. Patrick's Day parade in South Boston, where he saw what seemed like an entire American city celebrating his small country, became a source of pride.
You know, like there were hundreds of thousands watching it and thousands of people marching, and it just seemed to be a day for everybody. And it was great that here in America that they were celebrating, you know, a day from my little country. Like, you know, Ireland's a really small country, but yet it seemed to have had such a big, created a big footprint in Boston. And so it was wonderful to be a part of it all.
O'Connor was a spectator his first year in Boston, but 2 years later, he would march in the parade. It would take a court order to get him there, and that would lead to a 3-year legal fight that would take O'Connor and GLAAD to the United States Supreme Court in GLAAD's case, Hurley v. Glibb, the Irish-American gay, lesbian, and bisexual group of Boston. Glibb formed in 1992 as a social group that aimed to show the diversity in Boston's Irish LGB community. Glibb's members were male and female, young and old, Catholic and Protestant, but all members in some way considered themselves part of the Irish community. As part of this community, the group in 1992 planned to march in South Boston's annual parade. So before St. Patrick's Day that year, Glibb co-founder Barbara Kay contacted the parade's Grand Marshal, Thomas Lyons, and asked to register. Lyons sent Kay a registration letter on City of Boston stationery, welcoming Glibb's participation and asking that Kay return the form. Kay complied. 2 weeks later, Lyons sent Kay a handwritten note. "Dear Ms. Kay," it read, "Your application has been denied for safety reasons and insufficient information regarding your social club." Boston's St. Patrick's Day Parade runs a 4.5-mile route through the center of South Boston, a heavily Irish-American neighborhood locals call Southie. Each year, the parade has nearly 500,000 onlookers and tens of thousands of marchers. In Boston, the parade, and St. Patrick's Day itself, does double duty. It also commemorates Evacuation Day, one of the first major victories of the Revolutionary War. Before the local Irish community gained political power, Evacuation Day, not St. Patrick's Day, was the main cause for celebration. But as the Irish became more prominent, South Boston's Evacuation Day events developed stronger ties to the Irish holiday. Officially, the parade was called the City of Boston Evacuation Day St. Patrick's Day Parade. For most of its history, the city and the South Boston Allied War Veterans Council shared parade sponsorship. Wanting to honor veterans returning after World War II, Boston Mayor John Curley, in 1947, asked the Veterans Council to co-sponsor the parade. The City of Boston continued to help finance it, and city officials helped with organization and administration. As the parade's popularity grew in the later 20th century, so did the diversity of participants. Some registered to march in advance, other groups simply showed up the day of the parade. There was no formal application or screening process. That changed in 1992. In their rejection of GLIB for the 1992 parade, the Veterans Council argued that the group couldn't guarantee its members' good behavior. Although GLIB proposed to do nothing more than march carrying a banner bearing the organization's name, the council said GLIB posed a safety concern. It was the first time that the veterans voted to reject the registration of a group admitted to the parade. GLAD Civil Rights Project Director Mary Bonato, then in her second year as a GLAD attorney hired to enforce Massachusetts' 1989 non-discrimination law, met Barbara Kay before the 1992 parade. Bonato remembers when Kay received the rejection letter from Thomas Lyons.
She came in that afternoon. I called the ACLU in Massachusetts, and I called another attorney who I know, and we all got to work about how to get these folks in the parade. And the thing that was most important legally in 1992 was that it was clear it was a city-sponsored parade. The invitations for the parade and a lot of the official stationery was all on City of Boston letterhead. And when it's a government parade, the government can't discriminate between messages and messengers.
GLIB and the Veterans Council, headed by Korean War veteran John Hurley, who called himself Wacko, couldn't reach an agreement to let GLIB march. Represented by GLAD and the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, GLIB filed for an injunction, arguing that its exclusion was based on sexual orientation, in violation of the state public accommodations law. The council argued that GLIB violated the values the veterans sought to express in the parade. On March 12, 1992, Suffolk Superior Court Judge Hiller Zobel ordered the veterans to allow 25 GLIB members to march in the parade the following week. Kathleen Finn, one of the 1992 marchers who later became a GLIB leader, says for her, GLIB's fight was about identity and community. It was about being who you are and being included.
I am 100% Irish, and I'm 100% bisexual, and they're both important aspects of who I am. And, you know, it's in life you want to have the opportunity to really be your authentic self and not to have to hide. And that's really what it was about.
Mary Bonato.
Gay people were saying, we are gay people, and we want to be open gay people and still participate in ordinary civic events. And to be able to do both of those things at once, not to do it as closeted, but to do it and to be open about it and even march under a banner saying that you are gay, was the thing that was so hard to wrap those two things together. The whole reason this organization existed, in their words, and I'm roughly paraphrasing here, but was to celebrate that there are gay people who are also Irish, and there are Irish people who are also gay, and to enjoy and relish that heritage.
All eyes were on South Boston in March 1992. GLIB's case earned national, even international, media attention. Reporters quoted Southie residents saying GLIB marchers weren't welcome. They'd get whooped. They deserved what was coming to them. GLAD and Boston police worked to prepare GLIB for confrontations along the parade route. Local police told Southie residents protesting GLIB to turn their backs to the parade instead of turning to violence. Still, no one knew what to expect. Some younger GLIB marchers drew up their first wills. According to Kathleen Finn, they just weren't sure they were going to make it. The 25-person GLIB contingent marched five people across by five deep, carrying the GLIB banner. Uniformed police escorted them, and as backup, a U-Haul truck carrying a concealed SWAT team drove in front of them. Kathleen Finn.
I remember there were snipers on top of roofs. I remember that there were a lot of riot police available, and there were also police on motorcycles that were escorting us to try to provide a barrier and a buffer, and yet we were still able to march. And for many of us, it was, you know, it was a traumatic experience, and at the same time it was exhilarating because we were able to really identify ourselves, both in terms of, like, for me, being Irish American, I belonged in the parade, as well as being bisexual, and that I didn't have to hide that part of myself to be part of it.
Dave O'Connor.
Now, I remember there was another friend of mine, Michael Connolly, from Dundalk in Ireland, and the two of us swore that if that banner went on the ground, it would be picked up no matter what. We would get that into the truck as well, that banner wasn't going to be left behind. But it never got to that stage. There were a lot of protesters, but there were a lot of people cheering us on too. It was the longest 4 miles of our life, but we did it, and we were very pleased. We behaved impeccably, but why wouldn't we? I know one person got a stone in the head that required some medical attention, but I think that was the only thing. And there were several arrests that happened. There were a lot of people with, you know, fags burn in hell and those kind of signs. It was kind of a little more hairy than I thought it was going to be, but that just made it more important that we participate. You know, that if people didn't want us there so much, there must be some reason for us to be there. You know, that if people were trying to silence who we were, it just meant that our message was more important. And so it became much more than my initial naive desire to participate. It was like, these people don't want us to exist. They want this to be some caricature of an Ireland or an Irish community that doesn't exist anymore, and by our voices being silenced, we'll buy into that. And that just, I couldn't let that happen, nor could the others who participated.
After 1992, the Veterans Council took steps to privatize the parade. They refused the City of Boston's annual financial contribution for 1993. The city seal disappeared from parade correspondence, and for the first time, the council didn't use the city's printer for parade materials. Despite these superficial changes, Glib argued that the parade remained a public civic event. Mary Bonato.
There were depositions of people who worked for the city departments. There were depositions of, you know, individuals in the Allied War Veterans Council, and they all hewed to the same line. Nope. Nothing to do with it anymore. You know, we just provide sanitation services, just like any other parade. We're not involved in doing this anymore. And, you know, we couldn't get anybody to admit what we thought was going on. So eventually we did have a hearing in front of a Judge Flannery in the Superior Court. And he ruled that it was a private parade at that point, but that the parade was also, under Massachusetts law, a place of public accommodation. It was open to and accepting of members of the general public. You know, you could have people on the sidelines who jumped in, organizations who had not registered who could jump in, and it wasn't a particularly selective organization. It was something that was really open to all who, on that day, wanted to celebrate and march in that parade.
Not surprisingly, the veterans rejected Glib's application to the 1993 parade. Again, the group got a court order saying that 25 of their members could march. And along with his ruling that the parade was a place of public accommodation, Superior Court Judge Flannery issued a permanent injunction allowing gay and lesbian marchers the same rights as all other participants. The Veterans Council appealed Flannery's ruling to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. And in March 1994, in Glib's seventh consecutive court victory, the SJC upheld the group's right to participate in the parade. Faced with the prospect of an unrestricted Glib contingent, the Veterans Council canceled the 1994 parade. Then they appealed the Massachusetts court's decision to the United States Supreme Court. From the beginning, the Hurley case was about discrimination. But by the time it reached the United States Supreme Court in 1995, the Veterans Council had reframed it as a First Amendment issue. The First Amendment didn't surface as an issue until the council failed in their initial attempts to exclude Glib from the parade, first citing public safety concerns, then because they were radical gay activists, and then due to Glib's alleged sexual theme. When these arguments failed with Massachusetts courts, the council recast the parade as a private event with specific messages. GLAAD founder John Ward argued the case in the first appearance at the U.S. Supreme Court by an openly gay attorney. Ward says the veterans argued that they had the right to choose the parade's messages and its messengers.
That they had the right to decide who was in it, who was out, based on some sort of amorphous criteria that they had, but which they had never employed. So our argument was that that's merely a pretext, you know, to discriminate. And that there were Supreme Court cases that say that you can't use the Constitution to support, you know, an invidious discriminatory purpose. We analyzed it as implicating the right of free association, that was the right that they were claiming, and that you can't use free association to mask discrimination. But the Supreme Court took a very different view of it.
The Supreme Court reversed the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruling on June 19th, 1995. Writing for the unanimous court, Justice Souter said, "The issue in this case is whether Massachusetts may require private citizens who organize a parade to include among the marchers a group imparting a message the organizers do not wish to convey. We hold that such a mandate violates the First Amendment." Again, John Ward.
The thing is that the case was really very, very fact-specific, and our argument was very, very fact-specific. It had to do with that historically the veterans were basically neutral gatekeepers. That was the role that they had adopted. They had been given this thing as a sort of a reward for their service in World War II. And they were sort of like the people that threw the party, but they didn't really create the guest list. You know, I mean, basically it was come one, come all. But, you know, there's a sort of a way to kind of gloss over the facts and just kind of move to a different level of abstraction, which is what the Supreme Court did. And then the other thing that it sort of came down to was the group carried a sign that said glib or something. That became the sort of this important distinction. Well, if they had denied individuals the right to participate as individuals based on their sexual orientation, that would have been a legitimate, it would have been a legitimate application of the state anti-discrimination laws to forbid that they couldn't exclude you or me or somebody else as an individual from participating based on some sort of personal characteristic, you know. But the fact that they carried this flag, and our thing was, well, that, you know, without this banner, there was no way of identifying themselves. You see? That it wasn't saying, you know, gay is good. It was just saying that here we are. To us, that seemed to be quite a crucial distinction.
Despite the loss, the case marked significant progress for LGB people. The Supreme Court decision itself was respectful in tone, and it recognized that coming out and being out are expressive, that saying you're gay means something. LGB people also became visible in ways they hadn't been before. The case reinforced the public understanding that gay people have complex identities, just like all other people. A person can be gay and other things at the same time. Mary Bonato.
It's one of those situations where I hope that the years of litigation around this, whatever the result of the litigation, that the most positive thing about it is that it started a discussion or added a new dimension to the discussion about, can you be gay in something else that's so very mainstream, i.e. having an ethnicity, at the same time, and to begin to see that gay people want to be whole people in whatever ways that may be to them. They want to be whole by being parents and gay, by being a teacher and gay, by being Irish and gay. And I tell you, I think a lot of people with the years of debate and discussion about this really felt like this shouldn't be a big deal. It shouldn't be a big deal for these people to participate in this parade. So it may be one of those cases where we lost the battle, but won the court of public opinion.
GLIB disbanded after the Hurley decision, but many of its members are still in touch. And given the chance, many would still march in Boston St. Patrick's Day Parade to celebrate their heritage, their identities as proud Irish people who are also gay, lesbian, and bisexual. Kathleen Finn.
That's how I always feel about it. It should be an inclusive parade. And I think what the parade organizers overlook is the richness that comes with that diversity of really having a representative group that participates. And just having us march down the street isn't going to make some kid gay, you know. We still have a lot of education that we need to do. I mean, just any of us, we can be an example just by being out in our community and by living a good life and being willing to help our neighbors and pay our taxes and work hard in our jobs. And I just think that that makes a big difference in terms of how people see us. That we're really actually not that different from them.
Thank you for listening to this GLAD 30th Anniversary podcast. Visit glad.org to learn more about this story and to download a new podcast on the 15th of every month.